I'm David Suchet, and this is Blood Ties.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell, and I'm here with my father, Jeffrey Wansell.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Thank you for listening to another extraordinary story. This one is quite remarkable. But before that, how's your week been, Mo?
Busy. I'm very busy.
Busy.
I went to see a play that lasted 3 hours and 50 minutes.
Good Lord.
I think a little too long.
Yes, it's like Lear, isn't it? You have to make a commitment, a life commitment to seeing another Lear.
Yeah, but that's Shakespeare, so you sort of know what you're in for, don't you?
Yes.
I don't love Shakespeare, controversially.
Oh, I'm not desperate to see another Romeo and Juliet. I got sent one book this week, which I really am very interested to read. This is called The Fatal Passion of Alma Rattenbury by Sean O'Connor. Now, Alma Rattenbury was a famous case, which we'll do as a podcast, but not in this current season.
Okay.
But it was an absolute...
Where's Alma from?
Oh, it's English.
Oh, it's English.
It's English. She and her lover, the chauffeur, conspired to kill her husband. The question is, which one did it?
Does it matter?
It does. It matters
Isn't
a great...
Isn't it a folie à deux, whatever the phrase
Well,
is.
It might be a folie à deux, but the fascinating thing about Alma Rattenbury is that she inspired Terence Rattigan's final play, Cause Célèbre, which is based entirely on the Rattenbury case. So I'm not going to spoil the story because I want to use it in a later podcast.
But you like the book.
But I like the book. I haven't had much of a chance to read it. It comes out very soon. A good paperback. It got well reviewed in hardback. It's a very, very good story.
Good.
And as I say, I'm not going to spoil it by telling you the denouement.
Uh-huh.
But it happened in 1935. It's a very good story indeed.
Hmm.
So that's been one thing that's inspired me this week. And I've had a very...
Wasn't this lunch this week?
Yes, I did. That was on Monday.
Jeffrey hosted a lunch.
Yes.
Très chic. Coq au vin.
Well, it was actually very good coq au vin. Yes. Yes, it was it's what's not in the history of the Garrick. I told lots of Garrick stories.
Ah, but that aren't in your book. Jeffrey's also written a book, twice the book of the history of the Garrick Club.
I have, yes.
Can you buy that in normal bookshops, or can you only buy it in the club?
No, you can order it.
You can order
it. It's the Garrick story of a club. You can order it. I think it's on Amazon. I'm not sure.
Okay.
When you're elected a member, you're sent a copy, and with the assumption being that you'll buy it.
You're sent it, but we're supposed to return it if you don't pay for it.
That's right.
Right,
yes. Although, of course, nobody ever does return
it. No, of course. So everyone just gets a free copy of the
Everyone
book.
Gets a book, you know.
That's very smart.
Which means whenever I meet a new member, met a new member yesterday, and they all say, oh, yes, I've been really enjoying the book. Yes, I've got up to Dickens. I thought, well, you've got a good way to go then. it's fascinating.
I've had a lot of messages on Instagram this week.
Oh, good.
Thank you, everyone, for taking the time to write to us and give your comments on our podcast. And, we are thoroughly appreciative. Had lots of nice messages.
Awesome.
Hello, I love your podcast. I was wondering, might you discuss Stuart Lubbock? I don't know Stuart Lubbock.
Yes, we will, but maybe not this season.
From Kate. We're already all booked up this season.
Yeah.
Hello.
Stuart Lubbock's a very good story.
Love your podcast. Have you thought about doing one on Christopher Foster, who killed his wife and daughter and then set fire to his house?
That's a story I don't know.
I don't know that one. I love your podcast. I listen in Australia every night.
Good Lord. How extraordinary.
Have you thought about doing the awful story of Tia Sharp? Everybody's got lots of good ideas.
Yes, please keep sending them. It's great for me as well because I have to find out about cases which I don't know.
Erica's written to us. Greetings from the US. I absolutely love your podcast.
Well, thank you, Erica.
Listening to you and your dad is so heartwarming.
Well, let's hope so. Even if the subject matter isn't always all that heartwarming.
She says, tell Jeffrey and Betsy hello too.
No, very good.
Thank you. Anyway, I've had messages like that all week. It's been great. I've really enjoyed it.
Well, it's wonderful. It's very exciting and very inspiring, actually.
Do you keep writing to us? One message I had from a lady, she said, please can you say hello to all of your Canadian listeners?
Hello to all our Canadian listeners. Thank you for listening.
We're very appreciative.
We are very, very appreciative. We have a lot of listeners around the world. It's quite amazing.
So the case we're doing this week is an American case. Is that right? And it was recommended by a listener. We're trying to make sure we do listen to you. So we will get to those cases you've suggested.
We will.
This was suggested by Christine White on the 29th of December.
Well, Christine, thank you very much. It's a case I only vaguely knew about, but a very interesting one. It's the story of H.H. Holmes, said to be America's first serial killer.
Well, there you go. America's first serial killer.
Holmes wasn't born H.H. Holmes. He was actually born Herman Webster Mudgett in Gilmanton, New Hampshire, in the United States, on May the 16th, 1861.
Victorian, my favourite.
He was a quite clever boy, but he became notorious because in the age of what were known as the Penny Dreadfuls, awful lot of myths began to circulate around H.H. Holmes, egged on by Mr. Holmes himself.
Well, hold on. Maybe we should just... What's Penny Dreadful?
Ah, Penny Dreadful was an early version.
I know it was a TV show with Ava Green. No. I never watched it.
No, no. Penny Dreadfuls were early magazines.
Well, of course they were. Yeah, yeah.
Early magazines which told very elaborate and rather, how can one put it, dramatic stories.
Like an early version of serialisation. It was sort of like an early form of Netflix, basically.
An early form of Netflix. indeed, Sherlock Holmes started in a way coming out weekly. So did Dickens.
Yeah, Dickens did.
Yeah. So, but the thing about a Penny Dreadful, particularly an American Penny Dreadful, was that they liked to embroider stories, adding extra bits. And one of the things about Holmes was that he was rumoured, alleged, to have killed 200 people. The reality is he admitted killing 27 people, of which only 9 were plausible. But what is absolutely true about Holmes is that he became an American tall tale. He certainly killed 9, no question, and maybe more. But it was embroidered and embroidered and embroidered, so there was an absolutely extraordinary myth surrounding him. So let's go back to the beginning.
Okay.
And when Herman Webster Mudgett was born, he was the middle of 5 children, 2 elder brothers, 2 sisters, 2 brothers. Bright boy. There was no history of abuse in the family, no harming animals, no arson, no sexual assault,
none of the normal stuff.
But he was fascinated, no question, by women. Indeed, one of the things about him was not only was he a fantasist and a con man and an insurance fraudster, but he was also a bigamist several times, as will become clear.
The bigamist, is the definition of bigamy marrying more than one woman at one time?
That's right.
Okay. So when you say he was a bigamist more than once, I mean, of course you're a bigamist.
He had three wives.
Of course you're a bigamist more than once.
He had 3 wives. The
definition of bigamy.
Yes.
Thrice bigamist.
Whatever you want to call it, darling. But his first marriage, when he was only 17, was to a lady called Clara Lovering on Independence Day, 1878, July the 4th. And they had a son called Robert Mudgett, who was born in February 1880. But in 1882, Mudgett went to the University of Michigan, Department of Medicine and Surgery, and learnt to be a doctor. He also learnt the art of dissection, which was to become extremely handy as he would eventually go into the body parts selling business, but that's only by the by. But by the time he'd graduated from the University of Michigan, Clara had gone back to New Hampshire, and because, to be honest, Mudgett was violent towards her and she couldn't stand it. There were all kinds of rumours surrounding Mudgett, that he was killing small boys in upstate New York and in Philadelphia. Like a lot of the American serial killers we've talked about, they tend to roam about a lot. They're never usually in one place. I mean, Bundy's the perfect example, their great arc across the country. Anyway, he finally moves to Chicago in 1886 and changes his name from Mudgett to Dr. H.H. Holmes because he wants to escape from the various scams, insurance scams of all kinds that he's been committing. So he goes to Chicago, changes his name to Dr. H.H. Holmes, and moves in to work in a drugstore owned by Elizabeth Holt and her husband. But when he gets to Chicago, he also marries. He hasn't divorced Clara. He marries for the second time a lady called Myrta Belknap, who was 24. They actually married in Minneapolis. They had a daughter, Lucy, on July the 4th. July the 4th happens a lot in the story of Holmes. She was born July the 4th, 1889, in Chicago. And they lived just outside the city in Wilmette. And then, believe it or not, 8 years later, but you'd better get the marriages out of the way first. 8 years later, in 1894, January 1894, he married the third time, Georgiana Yoke, in Denver, Colorado, while still married, of course, to Clara and to Myrta. And you might ask yourself how exactly he had the time to do this. I mean, but he was, what you have to admit about Holmes was that he was very, very resourceful. He was also something of an entrepreneur. Everything was a scam. He would, you know, always try and rip off insurance companies. Always. Whether it's property insurance, health insurance, life insurance. He was just simply addicted to being a con artist. But what he did was he got hold of a lot across from the Holtz drugstore on the other corner of 63rd Street and Wallace in Chicago, and built what became known as the Murder Castle. It was a shop fronts on the ground floor, and then upstairs were a whole series of rooms. And those rooms, there are any, many, many rumours and extraordinary...
What did he build it for originally, then?
He built it as an investment, but he also wanted somewhere to kill.
So he had he would have rented out the shop and the
he did
rooms.
Rent out the shops and the ground floor, but he also had, it also had a basement, of course. So the rumours about it were so profound. It was rumoured that it had airtight rooms that he could gas people in, torture chambers, hidden passageways, chutes from some rooms straight down into the basement so he could dissect the bodies. This was all built up in the Penny Dreadfuls. It was extraordinary.
But this is when he was... I have quite many questions. How did he get his victims? How did people start telling rumours about him? And if people thought that was going on in there, why didn't they stop it?
Well, the rumours didn't start until after Holmes had been executed.
Ah, okay.
And it was also very interesting, but again, I'm slightly leaping forward, that... The building, the so-called Murder Castle, was set on fire deliberately.
Did he use his doctorship? That's an incorrect word. His
medical training
to find his victims.
No, most of his victims, most of his plausible victims, not all the rumours about X, Y, Z, or the bragging he did. The real rumours were almost always his mistresses.
Ah, okay.
All the rumours about the Murder Castle were really pretty much that. But there is no doubt that he killed on a relentless basis. But what he did do was clearly dissect some of the victims and sold their body parts, rather like Burke and Hare did in Edinburgh in the 18th century. Holmes is so difficult to get to the reality of Holmes because so many stories grew up around him. But let's try and see if we can't nail down the things we can actually say. There was certainly a surgical table in the basement, and he certainly sold body parts to medical facilities.
Did they not question where these body parts come from?
No.
Okay.
Well, quite a lot.
Probably not actually back then.
No. Again, I mean, it happened in Edinburgh.
Yeah. No, I know it happened.
Famously.
Yeah, I know.
Anyway, if as far as we can assess, the first victim that we can actually put our finger on is a girl called Julia Smythe, who was his mistress, wife of a man who worked in the jewellery part of the pharmacy, and she had a daughter called Pearl. There's no question her husband left her when he discovered the affair and left town. Julia and Pearl stayed, and they both disappeared on Christmas Eve, 1886. There's no doubt in my mind that they represent the first two plausible victims of Holmes. The second was Emmeline Sigranda, another mistress, who actually worked for him as his stenographer in the castle in May 1892 and disappeared in December 1892.
Okay.
The third victim, again, another mistress, Edna von Tassel, also disappeared. But we can't be sure that she was a victim. We suspect, but it's not absolutely clear. Anyway, around this time, in early 1893, Holmes meets and befriends a man called Bernard Pitsell, who becomes, according to the district attorney at Holmes's trial, his creature. He was a carpenter, part-time criminal.
What, like Eagle?
Yeah, sort of.
His creature, like his
his
minion.
His minion. And, it'll become clear why this is so important when we get close to the trial. So let's take a break for a moment and pick up the victims again. The fourth victim, as far as we can see, is an actress who went to work for Holmes and moved in with him early in 1893. And her sister Annie came too. Both were never seen again after Independence Day 1893.
They just loved the 4th of July.
Mm. They disappeared. But, of course, with Holmes there was always an ulterior motive. He'd persuaded Minnie to hand over the deeds to a house she owned in Fort Worth in Texas. And Holmes fled to it, to that house, after the fire at the Murder Castle. Now, no one could be sure whether Holmes set fire to the Murder Castle himself or whether someone else did it.
Do we know how many plausible murders had taken place before the fire?
Yes, at least four.
Four or five? Was it?
Yeah,
four.
At least four. It is, funnily enough, he'd built a third, by this time, Holmes had built a third floor onto the second floor in British terms for the World's Fair in 1892. It was to have been a hotel, but in fact was never used. Yet more issues. But funnily enough, the Murder Castle on 63rd Street wasn't destroyed by the fire, and in fact it was refurbished and became a post office. And it was a post office until well into the 1930s.
Oh.
Yeah, so if you look it up, if you look Holmes up, it shows you the drawings, which are very penny dreadful, you know, in murder rooms, torture rooms, all that.
Yeah.
And you actually look, then there's a picture of the post office. It's a kind of wonderful juxtaposition of the two. Anyway, Pitsell and he come up with another scam. Pitsell, they're going to fake Pitsell's death so that Holmes can share the life insurance with Pitsell.
How much life insurance would a creature have?
Well, it would be
a bit.
But the problem was, Pitsell, it all went wrong. Holmes was trying to find a body to stand in for Pitsell, and in the end couldn't. And so, I mean, it's awful to say, and please forgive me, but in the end, Pitsell's death wasn't faked. Holmes killed him with chloroform and then set fire to him.
Oh, that's awful.
And he collected the insurance money.
Unbelievable.
But the story gets even darker. Pitts and his wife had five children. Holmes persuades Pitsell's wife that he should be in loco parentis,
the new dad,
for three of the children, Alice, Nellie and Howard. And he was, they were in his custody while Mrs. Pitsell kept the other two. He then proceeds to take the children on a tour of the northern states of the US, which ends up in Canada. Not only that, he also is persuading Mrs. Pitsell and the other two children to conduct a similar tour. I mean, I know it's, but he was very kind of persuasive. So they're only like a state behind them, or, you know, a block at one point behind them. But the tragedy of it, of course, was that eventually Holmes killed the three Pitsell children.
Yeah.
The two girls were locked in a trunk and gassed. And the boy was poisoned.
Is there any, or maybe you'll get to this with the trial, but did he give any, was there any sort of reason for it?
No.
There's no kind of rhyme or reason
not
to
really.
The...
Not really, no. The Pitsell killing, which is the one for which he's tried, there's clear motive.
And the lady actress with the house.
Yes, yeah. But basically... He was an opportunist.
He just liked killing. Yeah, or he just was living a kind of
a wild fantasy.
Wild life.
Yes. In the end, it was Alice and Nellie's bodies were found in Philadelphia and the boys were found in Indianapolis in July 1895 and October 1895. But Holmes was only put on trial for the Pitsell killing, for the father. Although it was perfectly clear that he'd killed the three children, and indeed it began to emerge the various other victims that I'd been through. Pitsell confessed, quotes, to 27 killings in Chicago, Indianapolis and Toronto, where he'd ended up. It was mostly fantasy, but one thing is absolutely clear. Holmes loved notoriety. He absolutely loved it.
So he just wanted to be... Do you think he was doing all that stuff because he wanted to be famous?
Yep, I do. There's one marvellous quote which I'm just trying to dig out.
Jeffrey's just reaching for his trusty laptop.
Oh, it's gone away again. Which implies that he was born with the devil in him.
The quote that he gave?
Yep.
Well, I think probably we've discussed this before, but I think if you do go around or you have a desire to wreak that much havoc on other people, you must have that. Bit like, not the same, but Sharon Carr wrote about that, didn't she?
Which she did
we
indeed.
Talked about a lot last week, and about, you know, having that desire to kill.
The point is, I'm not going to find the quote, I've got too much trouble, but it basically said, I was born with the devil in me.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Which I think is, in many ways, expresses Holmes very well. Mm. What Holmes was, however, was an incredible braggart. If you look at a picture of him...
Let me look a picture of him.
He's got a wonderful moustache. He looks much older than he was.
Oh, yeah. He's got a very big moustache.
Very, very big moustache.
He looks young, though.
Well, he was hanged just days before what would have been his 35th birthday.
Yeah, you can tell that even though he's got a moustache and I see thinning hair, he is young. He's young.
Yes, he was born. I was hanged on May the 7th, 1896, for the murder of Bernard Pitsell. But isn't it wonderful? Even in death, Holmes wanted to make a point. He insisted that his casket should be entombed in cement because he was convinced there were going to be grave robbers. The man had a fantasy life which is quite extraordinary. He was convinced that people were going to steal his body. And believe it or not, the prison authorities did that. And indeed, in 2017,
mm.
not long ago,
yeah.
he was exhumed.
Why?
They wanted to make sure it was him. And he was discovered to be very well preserved.
Well, if you're buried in concrete, you would be.
Yeah, it was absolutely. It's one of those miracles.
Huh.
He's created all these myths around him. And as you and I often say to one another, he's worthy of a movie.
Well, apparently there has been one,
well,
but
there have been several, not been released. No, Martin Scorsese
is
making The Devil in the White City, which is the murder mansion,
mm.
with DiCaprio
mm-hmm.
as Holmes,
mm.
Probably for Netflix. Holmes, for me, is something of an enigma. Part of him just couldn't stop killing. But part of him is almost as if he was playing. I know a lot about all kinds of different killers, but there's something playful almost about Holmes. It's ugly to say, and he killed.
I see what you mean.
It doesn't seem. It seems kind of devil may care almost.
Yeah.
There's a sort of extraordinariness. He's got these three wives. He's got Pitzel's.
Just doesn't abide by any laws no. of society at all no. in any way.
No convention.
Mm.
No. Despite coming from a perfectly respectable family, which apparently he had and he graduated as a doctor.
Oh, but he did. Yeah, so he's not stupid.
By far. By no means.
Just a fantasist.
Yes. Who lives in this extraordinary world of, you know, well, everyone's my victim, or everyone's potentially my victim. There were tales in the Penny Dreadfuls, particularly after his hanging. Oh, 200 victims, vats of acid, torture rooms, dissections. All these people were killed while they were alive.
He'd probably be thrilled to know that.
I think he would be absolutely thrilled to have known it. I think it was one of those. How can I put it? It was a tabloid, we would say in this country, a tabloid dream.
Yeah,
you know.
Exactly.
You know, imagine what would have happened if the same sort of thing had happened in this country. I mean, we had it with the West, didn't we?
But also, timings-wise, with the Jack the Ripper, we had exactly the same thing.
Yes.
Just a lot more sinister.
Yes.
I mean, all murder is sinister.
All murder is sinister. But there was even one rumour that he was Jack the Ripper and he'd gone to England. I mean, absolute nonsense, of course. But that's typical of the myths that surround Holmes. He was this incredible figure in American folklore in that time, at the end of the 19th century.
Yeah.
And hence, he created myth after myth after myth. And it's very difficult to pick your way through exactly what happened and at what point.
And there's a lot of stuff and stories.
Yes, most of which I don't believe. I do believe he confessed to killing 27 people, but some of the people he confessed to killing were still alive, including the owner and wife of the first drug store he went to, Elizabeth Holt. It was always said that he'd killed them. He didn't. They were still alive. They lived a ripe old age.
How odd.
You know, he was embellishing his own fantasy.
Yeah.
And then it was embellished still further. It was a kind of, it's Bluebeard, if you like, you know, and it becomes even more dramatic. But Holmes is a wonderful, thank you, Christine, for suggesting it.
Yeah, thank you, that was so interesting.
It was a wonderful story.
Yeah.
And this man with a huge moustache, marrying three times, having endless mistresses, killing most of them, and then killing, for no reason anybody can really understand, the three Pitzel children who were in his care. It's horrid, but at the same time, it's rather utterly extraordinary.
Very. Well, thanks, Dad. That was America's first serial killer.
Well, what are you doing the rest of the week? What are you doing this coming week, my darling? Not much.
I'm going to Frankfurt.
Oh, yes, you're off to Frankfurt.
Yeah.
When do you leave?
Friday.
Lovely.
I'm only going for one night. to Frankfurt, but I'm sure it will be very nice. I've not been to Frankfurt before.
No, I'm sure it'll be very nice. I've never been to Frankfurt.
There's Berlinale that same time, weekend as well, but I'm not going to Berlin.
Oh, you're just going to Frankfurt?
Mm.
Okay, okie dokie. Mm-hmm. And you're going to see two of your clients in a play?
Yes, two of my clients are in a play in Frankfurt called The Effect, which I think is written by Lucy Breville, she said.
Okay.
What about you?
What am I doing this coming week? I don't know. Oh, a lot more reviewing, that's for sure. I kind of alternate between podcast researching and reviewing. So on alternate weeks.
Yeah.
I have to do some reviews. I've got a couple of things. Mostly I spend my time reading crime and thrillers. If I'm not doing podcasts, I'm reading. I read very good ones, some of them. There's a new Lucy Foley, who's very good young crime writer, who had a big hit with a thing called The Hunting Party last year. And now she's written her second one called The Guest List.
I think we talked about The Hunting Party.
I think we did. Well, the follow-up, or the second, is extremely good. This time, instead of it being a lodge in the Highlands of Scotland, we're on a remote island off the coast of Ireland where a wedding is being planned.
Well, it's the classic setup, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the locked room.
Yeah, locked room.
It's the locked room setup.
Yeah.
But this is Agatha Christie on speed. I mean, this is, you know, there's a lot of sex in it.
Oh.
And very much not Agatha Christie.
I don't remember
Christie.
Much of that in Agatha Christie.
There wasn't any. That's absolutely true. But it is, I have to say, very good. And the butler didn't do it. That's all I'm prepared to say.
Okay, well, thanks.
Nor did the wedding planner.
Oh, bear that in mind. Well, thank you, Dad. And thank you to all of the people that help us.
Yes, thank you all.
Thank you, Poppy Damon, our producer. Thank you, Audio Boom, for hosting us. My brother Dan, who does the music. My friend George, who drew our caricature. And my friend Hannah, who helps us with all things podcast.
Yes.
And thank you to you, Jeffrey, for doing all the research and the hard work and telling us the stories.
No, it's a pleasure. I did something for BBC Radio Bristol last week and about Cary Grant. And I just told the story. And the man said, "That's wonderful." And I said, "Well, that's probably what I do, really, is just tell stories about... So yes, do, and many, many thanks to all the people who help us, and especially
the listeners,
and especially to you, the listeners. And
you're,
as I often
without
say,
without you, we're nothing.
Well, absolutely, but more important even than that is, as I always say, it really bad things happen to good people. Holmes is a good example of that. So do be careful out there.